Nuclear films. The International Uranium Film Festival is touring the United States, where it is not only presenting movies from around the world, but providing space for community ingathering and activist networking. It's an important opportunity for anti-nuclear warriors to strengthen themselves and their actions. This year, as it has three previous times, the festival begins in Window Rock, Navajo Nation, which is located in Arizona. Why Navajo Nation? It takes a veteran activist on both indigenous people and uranium issues to spell it out clearly. And when he tells you...
The reality of the Navajo people is that we live right in it. All our land is surrounded by uranium mines and radioactivity and poisoning and the yellow cake, the mines and the mills that were here, the underground uranium mines earlier, over 500 are still open and they need to be remediated, right? So we can't just get up and leave. This is our home. This is our homeland. So there's certain realities that we have is that we just got to continue the fight. We call uranium yellow monster.
Well, it takes Norman Patrick Brown, a renowned filmmaker, writer, educator, actor, and respected voice of indigenous people, as well as a recent award winner, we'll get to that, to explain the core issues of uranium that surround Navajo Nation. And then, when he and you and many others participate in the two-day International Uranium Film Festival, you begin to understand what it really means to be a people surrounded by uranium with no reliable recourse to justice from federal, state, or local government, and how insidious is this yellow monster of uranium and the central part it plays in the ongoing nuclear nightmare that keeps all of us stuck in that awful, deadly, dangerous seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, a special full-length report on the International Uranium Film Festival, or IUFF, which just concluded the first stop on its U.S. tour with 2 days at Window Rock, capital of Navajo Nation, located in Arizona. It not only presented 14 films and some live performances, but it provided an in-gathering for local residents concerned with uranium issues, wanting both information and community to support their ongoing efforts. We'll hear from organizers, filmmakers, community activists, and film fans from around the world on the importance of this event, some dramatic reaction to the 14 brilliant films presented, plus live music and theater performances. All of it coming up in just a moment. Today is Tuesday, November 18, 2025, and here is this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Special. Navajo Nation Nuclear Films and the International Uranium Film Festival comes to Window Rock. The events kicked off at the Navajo Nation Museum, which provided not only a beautiful and comfortable auditorium for screening the films, but also a large lobby where Navajo activist groups set up tables for information, and we were all welcomed to mix, mingle, talk, network, make new friends, locate old friends, and join together on shared issues and concerns. It truly was an anti-nuclear homecoming. Norbert Sukhanek and Marcia Gomez de Oliveira, the festival's co-founders, who are based in Rio de Janeiro, flew in from their home to facilitate the festivities. As this was a view of not only the films, but the issues that surround and impact Navajo Nation, the entire 2 days were imbued with Navajo spirituality, language, and customs. Before the day's program began, I spoke with several individuals about where they came from and why they were there.
I'm Jan Budar, a secretary at the Nuclear Energy Information Service in Chicago.
What brought you here to the International Uranium Film Festival? Why are you here?
We did the International Film Festival in 2024, and we're going to do it again in 2026. And I had never been to anybody else's, and I wanted to come to this source and see what was going on.
What do you think the value is of having this many films in one place at one time, all dealing with nuclear issues?
It's because we'll know about them, and we can bring them to our own audience one by one as we see fit. Because we have a fairly large audience at Nuclear Energy Information Service, and they will need to see these movies, and we will want to show them.
I'm Daryl. I came from Los Angeles. I took Amtrak for 13 hours to participate in this Hogan ceremony at Uranium Film Festival.
What is the draw that inspired you to put up with that much travel and that long a time to get here?
Because I'm horrified about all the open uranium mines in the four states in the Southwest and the fact that they haven't been closed, and because people do not know how dangerous it is to breathe in the dust and live near it, and they don't understand how long-lasting uranium or any kind of radiation is, and I want to participate in this film festival, and I want to talk to other activists about techniques and how to get people more involved.
Let's talk when you're back in Los Angeles.
We have a date.
At the information tables outside the auditorium, I spoke with Anna Curtis of MAZE, the Multicultural Alliance for a Safe Environment. This is a coalition of community-based organizations working to restore and protect the land, water, and communities affected by uranium mining in the southwestern United States.
My name is Ava Curtis. I'm the Environmental Justice Coordinator for the Multicultural Alliance for a Safe Environment, or MACE.
What are you doing here at the International Uranium Film Festival, and what do you hope to get out of this experience?
So our organization works on uranium issues in New Mexico, cleanup and restoration, and protecting people's health. And we're here at this organization because it's a great way for people to hear more about these issues in a fun and exciting way. And I'm hoping to learn some new things today.
Are they going to let you away from the table so you can go inside and actually see some films?
I think so, yeah.
Standing at the MAZE table was a man who was at first reluctant to be interviewed, but he eventually agreed.
Brad Lahenio. I live at Redwater Pond Road, which is between the two tailings that's existing in Church Rock area. I'm here to support MAZE, other groups here, and learn more about what's out there through the films.
And you made the comment to me that you might be harsh. What did you mean by that?
Cussing and anger about certain things which I don't want to reveal about uranium. How they're supposed to be cleaning up, they're just postponing it, extending it, and working around the Navajo tribal structure, trying to get away with stuff. And the tribe's just giving up, giving in to them, to the mine companies.
What will it take to get them to move on the things that need to be moved on?
I have no idea. We're trying our best to voice our opinion and voice our comments, and we're working with EPA.
As the festival was about to start and we hurried to the auditorium, I spoke with a woman who proved very important to the narrative of the festival.
My name is Tony Pinedo. I'm here because I live in Gallup, a city south of here. And it is a border town, and everything that goes on in the Navajo Nation actually affects all border towns, all six border towns. So that's why we're here, because we know that our water has been infected. We know that our ground has been infected. We know that for years, the uranium mines have been left. They just left them, and they left the poisons. And unfortunately, a lot of people, which we don't have the data, have developed cancers. And that's why I tell my friends, I said, sometimes it feels like we're our own Aaron Brockovich out here, because we need people to understand that. Because now with the new administration, they're going to open up more places to destroy this natural, beautiful land, and then they won't clean it up. Somebody else will make the money, and our land will go to waste, and that's why we don't have... There's a long list of abuse on the Navajo Nation done by the government. It's not just uranium.
And why are you here at the film festival?
I'm here in support of the uranium activists and advocates, because I think that people need to know what has happened to our water, what can happen, and they need to be aware of these companies that come in. They're not coming in to help you. They're coming in to extract the minerals of this land that is Navajo land. It's not anyone else's land. And they're using it to benefit only a certain amount of people. Why the people here go with no restrooms, no good streets, no plumbing, no electricity. Why in 2025, when you have billionaires, we can't even get a toilet out here?
Tony provided an important further part of this experience, and we will return to her shortly. The day's program opened with a prayer offering and introduction in both English and Navajo by Anna Rondon, a dedicated lifetime activist for the rights of indigenous people. The greeting included a traditional Navajo drumming circle with singing of an American Indian movement song and ceremonial dancing. The Honorable Crystalline Curley, 25th Navajo Nation Council Speaker, spoke next. She is well known to Nuclear Hot Seat listeners for her RECA lobbying in Washington, D.C. for the Radiation Exposure and Compensation Act, action she took alongside Dawn Chapman and Karen Nickel from North St. Louis and Mary Dixon of Salt Lake City, Utah. She made great effort to get to the festival to speak to us all when Navajo Nation President Boo Nguyen, who should have been the one to greet us, did not. The morning focused on films of specific interest to Navajo attendees. First up was Yellow Dust, a film from 2000, directed by Dene Shoni De La Rosa, a 7-minute experimental video about what uranium from Navajo Nation was really used for. The rapid-fire montage of nuclear weapons explosions proved stunning and sobering, and the film made its powerful point with music, images, and a minimum of words. Then, The River That Harms, a 1987 film directed by Colleen Keane, the late wife of depleted uranium activist Damasio Lopez. It tells the story of the 1979 Church Rock disaster, the breach of a radioactive uranium mining waste pond that released 94 million gallons of radioactive contaminated water into the adjacent Puerco River, New Mexico's main water supply for the Navajo that live along the river, and a tributary of the major source of water for Los Angeles. Church Rock remains the largest radioactive waste spill in U.S. history, and while it happened only 3 months after the Three Mile Island nuclear meltdown, it received little public attention. The film was followed by a heartfelt honoring of director Colleen Keane and a discussion of her legacy. If there was any question of the power and importance of the legacy of films like The River That Harms, they were forever dispelled by Toni Tineta, the woman I interviewed before the festival started. I was in the lobby after the film ended and saw her burst out of the theater in a highly agitated state. I asked her what this was about.
You just discovered something, however, from a film that was just shown, The River That Harms. What just happened for you?
I am in shock. I didn't know that in 1979 we had the greatest uranium spill that has affected the Puerco River, but it makes sense now how people have been dealing with this uranium side effects, birth effects, the water killing the animals, not being able to eat or drink from the water, and our water being poisoned. I didn't know that in 1979 that United Nuclear had the biggest uranium spill, and they pretty much kept it quiet. And for $2,000 is all they got. At the very end was $2,000. But the point is that this is one of the biggest spills. It did not just affect New Mexico. I mean, Gallup, I mean, going through the line, Arizona, all the way to California. It's just disgusting that nobody has been held accountable for all this injustice. Totally. And they kept it quiet. I'm from Gallup. I was not born there, but I was raised from a little kid.
And you also said that there had been an impact directly on your family.
Well, yes, yes. I've drank the water from here, from Gallup. I grew up here. I played on the res with my friends. My son was born with disabilities, birth defects. And I think it was the water. What can I say now? Well, who's going to recompensate us? No one. We have to fight for ourselves, and we need to make sure that no more uranium mining companies come here, because that's what they're trying to do now, is they're trying to open up more things. And as we see, they just come and steal the minerals. We get left with nothing, and we get left with all this destroyed land, and nobody is held accountable. Where's United Nuclear Mine now?
That burst of awareness and the activism that is sure to follow remind us why seeing and having these films is so important. Next up came Ways of Knowing, a Navajo nuclear history about uranium contamination of these sacred lands. It was directed by Kayla Breit. Here's a brief clip.
Everywhere in the world, they hold sacred. The synagogues, mosques, temples, shrines, and churches. None of those places are contaminated. Our sacred places are contaminated.
What we do to the earth, what we do to the mountains, what we do to the water, what we do to the air, the soil, the trees, the plants, the medicines, we do it to ourselves in return.
The government knew that mining was bad. They knew it was bad for your health. They knew it could kill you.
Tests revealed the water had high levels of uranium.
The land pays a price. The people pay a price. Everybody pays a price for this energy.
Several of the attendees had backgrounds working in government on attempted cleanup of nuclear sites. One of them I spoke with is Paul Griego.
Very briefly, tell people what your nuclear background is.
Well, in 1978, I lived and worked in the Marshall Islands. I was part of the atomic cleanup, where we were attempting to clean up these islands that were contaminated with the nuclear testing. We had like 43 atmospheric nuclear tests there.
And you were involved with Runit Dome? And
yes, and then my job was I performed the radiological survey. I collected soil samples literally at ground zero. And the purpose was to be able to determine what was going to be encased in a nuclear blast crater that we entombed and it became Runit Dome, and what we simply dumped into the lagoon.
What do you find that you're getting out of the festival so far?
Well, coming out of the festival, I'm meeting some new people, and I'm also running into people that I've met before who are also involved in the nuclear legacy. I even got to get a signed book by one of the participants here.
That's the book by Damasio Lopez.
That's right. It's right here in front of me.
My Last Battle, Ban Uranium Weapons, Memoirs of a U.S. Air Force Veteran.
Yes.
And he and I will be talking much further about that when the book has its general release.
Good deal.
The next film shown was The Vow from Hiroshima, an intimate portrait of Setsuko Thurlow, who was 13 years old and at school in Hiroshima when the U.S. dropped the atom bomb in 1945. She was the only one of her 27 classmates to survive. The rest were burned alive. Her vow, that no one should ever again experience the same horrible fate. The film follows Setsuko through her decades of activism, especially with the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN, to the moment she finally achieves her dream of a nuclear weapons ban treaty. Since the making of this film, she officially accepted the Nobel Peace Prize on behalf of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. During our lunch break, there were reunions, networking, laughter, and the energy of committed people finding each other and taking advantage of their time together. I took the opportunity to stop by the table of the Navajo Birth Cohort Study and learn more about their work.
My name is Janelle Smith.
And you're here from?
The University of New Mexico College of Pharmacy. I do work for the Navajo Birth Cohort Program. We set up a booth here at the festival and just glad to be here to share some of our information with the community and people that are here to attend the festival.
What is this Navajo Birth Cohort Study studying?
Currently recruiting any pregnant moms aging from 14 to 45 years old, specifically living on the reservation, Navajo Nation, for 5 years, and delivering at any Indian hospital, Gallup Indian Medical Center, Chinle, and Fort Defiance, and Tuba City. We are looking at how the environmental influences impact mom while she's pregnant. And one of the environmental influences we're looking at is uranium. And we're looking at how uranium impacts mom and how it impacts baby while baby's in the womb and at delivery. And we do follow the child until they're 18 years of age. And we collect biospecimens such as blood, urine, hair, and shed teeth.
Anything remarkable that you can talk about yet?
We're just finding uranium concentration in baby and baby's urine, first urine at delivery, so they're impacted by it.
You're staffing a booth here today for this study. What are you getting out of the festival? Because you have been able to see some of the films so far.
Yes, I've seen a couple of films today, and they are very interesting. What really stood out to me about one of the films is how our Navajo people are really impacted by this. And we're looking at how it will help future generations for our Navajo people because we don't realize how bad this is. That's why I feel like I'm more involved in research studies with uranium and how we can help the future generations to come in their health and how, you know, their development.
I previously interviewed the head of the Navajo Birth Cohort Study, toxicologist and principal investigator, Dr. Johnny Lewis. She has recently retired, but as you heard from Janelle Smith, the study continues. We will link to that episode where I interviewed Dr. Lewis, Nuclear Hot Seat 437 from November 6, 2019, and it will be on our website under this episode, nuclearhotseat.com, episode number 751. The afternoon began with the 2025 film To Use a Mountain by director Casey Carter. It painstakingly goes over the search for a site for the proposed permanent deep geologic repository for high-level nuclear waste. The film, which adopts an observational yet sensitive tone, goes over the examinations done by the Environmental Protection Agency for 6 sites in Texas, Utah, Mississippi, Nevada, and ultimately landing on Nevada's Yucca Mountain, and what it means that the government seized the land to be used as a repository when it had been ceded to the Western Shoshone people in their 1863 Treaty of Ruby Valley, a treaty that is still legally valid and binding, except when the government has other priorities. The next film moved me to tears several times. If the Silence Could Be Broken tells the story of U.S. government manipulation of Native people that the United Nations has called genocide. But to the Navajo, it's everyday life. The film follows a small group of Diné, that, by the way, is the name that these people take for themselves, Diné Navajo families, fighting to hold on to their land, heritage, and beliefs, despite repressive, punitive U.S. policies going back to the early part of the 20th century. Family members featured in that documentary and the director addressed us afterwards and were honored from the stage. If the Silence Could Be Broken deals with coal mining as well as uranium mining, but the issues raised for the people are the same. I caught up with director Guy Morgan to talk more extensively about how his film came about, especially considering he started it more than 22 years ago. We ended the first day of the film showings with, again, drumming and a circle dance, to which everyone was invited. But the interactions that build community and connection went on long into the night. I managed to sit down for an interview with Navajo activist and organizer of the film festival, Anna Rondon, and we'll have that interview for you in just a moment. But first, you've just heard about some of the dangers that have persisted on Navajo Nation lands despite organized community resistance to new uranium mining, plutonium pit production, hauling of uranium ore on highways through their lands, downwinder issues, the unremediated Church Rock uranium tailings spill, and more. And realize that these issues are not limited to Navajo people and lands. They exist right in our own backyards, over our roads, in our air, water, soil, food, and maybe even in our DNA. We can do nothing about nuclear threats to health and safety without knowing the truth about nuclear. And communicating that truth is the purpose of Nuclear Hot Seat. We provide you with the information you need to understand what's happening in the nuclear industry, and we come from a position of not being influenced by the millions of dollars they spend in their never-ending weekly propaganda media machine. We cover what you face in human terms, threats to health, welfare, and safety, and what you, what we, what any of us can do about it. Every week, we bring you the kind of nuclear information that mainstream media just doesn't seem to have the heart, or time, or money to put on the air or in print. And on occasion, such as this past week, we're able to travel to events to bring you up close and personal with the work of committed activists and the scientists who support their positions. In order to keep doing this work, we need your help. Nuclear Hot Seat runs exclusively on donations and cannot survive without your support. So if you're grateful for the information you get from the show, now is the time to help us out. Be it a one-time donation or a monthly recurring donation of any size, you'll be supporting the services required to keep this program running. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donation is tax deductible. And we make it easy. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button, then follow the prompts. Or you can send money directly and without fees via Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. No amount is too small, no amount is too large, so don't wait. Go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate now and keep our nuclear news online. And know that whatever you can do to help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. And now we return to this week's special episode, Navajo Nation Nuclear Films and the International Uranium Film Festival in Window Rock. I managed to sit down with the powerful Navajo organizer and activist, Anna Rondon, to gain her thoughts on the festival.
I'm talking with Anna Rondon, who is the co-coordinator of this year's International Uranium Film Festival being held in Window Rock, Navajo Nation in Arizona. This is now the fourth time that Navajo Nation has supported and brought to your lands here, the International Uranium Film Festival. What is the importance of this festival to you?
First of all, thank you, LeBay, for getting our voices out through the galaxies with your podcast. I believe in these times right now that the nuclear weapons and nuclear energy corporate regime wants to resurge the uranium mining. And also with the AI data centers, they're using small nuclear reactors,
which, as we know, do not yet exist.
Throughout this country, we do not need any more uranium mining or any part of the nuclear chain to be slashed against the American people and Navajo and South Dakota, the Black Hills, Mount Taylor. All of these sites, sacred sites, are under attack again. So these films are very important because they're modern films now, and they're getting the evidence of the crime scene throughout this country about the atrocities
of the nuclear industry, of violating the very essence of life, of the sanctity of us having this gift of life, and they have destroyed thousands and millions of children and people around the world with the nuclear monster.
How do you think the film's being here and being seen by so many people influence the forward steps you are taking in fighting against the nuclear evil?
A lot of us that come here, we know about the issues, but these films, I hope they go into the communities, because the communities can have their own little community film festival and celebrate that we are still here, regardless of what we've been through as Indigenous peoples.
And what chance might there be for this year's films to be posted on YouTube as perhaps a Navajo nuclear film channel for people to be able to pick up on them and see them and show them?
That is a great idea. And that is something that Indigenous Lifeways, Dene Care, these young Navajo environmental groups can take up, because I believe the International Uranium Film Festival here on Navajo has outgrown its space. And I believe that with new, younger filmmakers, they're bringing a different perspective to this issue in terms of reparations, shining light, and radiating the truth about the destruction of this industry and how the United States government needs to be accountable, because nuclear weapons are illegal.
They are against the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, which has been passed and ratified at the United Nations.
And the other issue, too, is depleted uranium is still being used, and we're not even being educated about it. Is it being used in Ukraine? Because for us in Ukraine, the grandmothers there gifted us with the beautiful flowered scarves. And that's what we have in common with the people that are under attack with these modern wars. So the indigenous peoples of Ukraine really have, over the seas, over the oceans, have brought beauty since the, I would say, the 1920s, with their beautiful scarves from Ukraine.
So the film festival becomes a rallying point or a focal point for groups around the world to put their voices together and join and find strategies and ways of working to work as a unified international force against nuclear.
Exactly. And I would say the past 50 years, there's been a lot of movement, opening doors, creating pathways for our generation now, but also for the future generation to have some legal and moral standing on the destruction of our lifeways. Now it's of all people throughout the world. But like Peterson Zaw said, we need to continue to have ceremonies. Mother Earth, Father Sky need to continue to have international ceremonies. And I think that's the next step. We need to have ceremonies at all our sacred sites around the world in unison at the same time. And that's another spiritual evolution of this revolution of fighting, because we need all the sacred powers and energies to combat. And we do have our corn pollen, which will combat this monster, because it's beauty. Changing Woman has blessed us with so much tools and sacred items to protect our people and to protect our way of life.
It's always an honor, a privilege, and a joy to rejoin with my friends on Navajo Nation and be of service to you in any way that I can. We'll keep this conversation going.
The second day of the festival, Friday, November 14, again started with prayers, drumming, song, and native dance. The first film, Born in Secret, follows filmmaker Riley Fitzpatrick on his return to his hometown, Oak Ridge, Tennessee, the secret city that was one of three locations that built the first atomic bombs. He interviewed workers who created humanity's most horrific weapon, who now wrestle with their legacy, while their grandchildren inherit a world on the brink of nuclear catastrophe. Then, Half-Life of Memory, America's Forgotten Atomic Bomb Factory. This award-winning 2024 film by director Jeff Geip rips the facade off Rocky Flats, the Colorado suburb of Denver, which secretly manufactured thousands of atomic weapons, leaving behind a toxic legacy that will persist for generations. But the history of the site, including fires, leaks, and illicit dumping of nuclear waste, has been covered up even as the radioactive truth of Rocky Flats continues to threaten public health. Few people are aware the plant ever existed, and now it's being considered a wildlife refuge, with new luxury homes being built just across the street. Filmmaker Jim Geip attended, and we got a chance to talk, not for the first time. Jeff Geip, we've just seen your film, The Half-Life of Memory, about Rocky Flats. What does it mean to you to have the film shown here as part of the International Uranium Film Festival, and specifically on Navajo Nation land?
You know, I'm really humbled because the First Nations people have really been the frontline communities for uranium milling, mining, and also their downwind of the nuclear test sites. So they have really experienced this firsthand on a level that is hard to explain. And so I just feel humbled because, you know, Rocky Flats is a vignette of this issue, and it is a community that's been affected. But they have so many more people, so much more land that's been affected here. And it's just amazing to be welcomed here.
How has the film been doing since its debut a year ago?
It's been going around the country, constantly have screenings, and it's been received really well. Thankfully, there's been a lot of interest in it locally and internationally, so it's rewarding in that sense.
Has there been any change in policy towards Rocky Flats as a result?
No, not necessarily. I think they have generally ignored it. Those in power have ignored this issue and ignored the film. But the word is getting out there. So that's the whole point, especially to raise awareness for the people that are in affected areas so that they know what happened there. You know, the history of the land, the fact that radioactive contamination still exists there, something they might not have realized prior to seeing the film.
And briefly, can you tell us what the new film is that you're working on?
So I'm actually working on two films that are sort of a spinoff in a way. One about the activism that occurred at Rocky Flats, which is an amazing story. The American Friends Service Committee started the Rocky Flats Action Group back in the 1970s and grew that into this mass movement that went national. And then the gal who started that, Pam Solo, she is a co-founder of the Nuclear Freeze Movement. So it was actually an international movement that, in my opinion, brought the end of the Cold War, brought the conditions for the end of the Cold War. And the other film is about the FBI and grand jury investigation at Rocky Flats, which is an incredible story, and it needs its own time and space to actually flesh that out. It's really amazing. It's the first and only governmental raid on a nuclear weapons facility.
And you'll be working with John Lipsky on that?
Yes, John Lipsky and Wes McKinley.
Can't wait.
I previously interviewed Jeff Geip at length about The Half-Life of Memory for Nuclear Hot Seat number 696 from October 23rd, 2024. We'll have a link up to that interview on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 751. Also attending and joining Jeff Geip in a post-film Q&A was John Lipsky, a former FBI agent who figures prominently in Half-Life of Memory. Here, he explains how he got involved with Rocky Flats and what his involvement meant to the case.
I was pleasantly surprised to discover that John Lipsky is here and was one of the people featured in Jeff Geip's film, The Half-Life of Memory. And he attended, answered some questions, and now he's going to do some more for the listeners of Nuclear Hot Seat. John, tell people what your background is.
I was a police officer in Las Vegas, Nevada, for 5.5 years, and then I was appointed as an FBI agent in 1984, and I have 20.5 years as an agent in Denver and Los Angeles.
How did you become involved with Rocky Flats?
Just lucky, I guess. Actually, because of the squad I was assigned, we were also assigned liaison duties, and since I was the new person on the block, I got what was considered the worst possible job of EPA liaison. And I just took my job seriously, and I also recognize that the whole gamut of environmental laws in this country was on the ground floor in 1984, and I was on it. And I didn't shirk my job, and I pursued it the best I could. And most importantly, the community was well aware of what should be looked at the most. And they all pointed to Rocky Flats. And that's what I was aware of when I went to Denver. But I have to thank the Rocky Mountain News, because they published a report that DOE turned over to Congress in 1987, part of an Energy Department review. The report said that some of the waste facility operations at Rocky Flats were patently illegal, and that was a DOE attorney. So when I went to tell my boss that I wanted to do a case on Rocky Flats, he said, "Are you in drugs?" And I said, "No, I have a confession." The DOE attorney had written and turned over to Congress. That was a confession. He admitted that they were fighting the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act and basically didn't want to have to pay any civil fines. They were above the law.
After you made yourself available to do this kind of a report, was that welcomed or did you hit pushback? And if so, what did the pushback do?
Well, the reaction to the report was, my boss was elated. He thought it was a great idea. But the U.S. Attorney's Office, the prosecutor that I worked with, said it wasn't going to go anywhere because the U.S. Attorney was such a Republican participant under Reagan at the time that the prosecutor said, "I'm not even going to dare talk about this report. We're going to just have to sit on it and hope we get a different person." So that's what we did. We waited a year for a new person to walk in the door. And when he did, the prosecutor I worked with said, "I think we have a shot at it now." But it wasn't a waste of time, because the reports that Rockwell and the Department of Energy had filed with the EPA and the State Health Department, there were 39 volumes of waste streams. And it took me a good year to go through all the 400 buildings and the waste streams and figure out what was what and what could be a criminal action.
This is going to be the subject of a new film that Jeff, I know, is working on with you, as well as information that's already in The Half-Life of Memory. How important do you feel it is to have this information about Rocky Flats in a film here at the International Uranium Film Festival in Navajo Nation and moving elsewhere beyond?
I think it's extremely important, because uranium is an issue here in Navajo land. Right now, the nuclear weapons complex, it's plutonium because of the more and more weapons that are going to be developed now. But it's all the same problem. We've got a government that doesn't abide by the law. They're not following the law. And I think as people start to resist and demonstrate, and we get to the point where what we saw this year in 2025, that the government's going to have to relent. They're going to have to give in. The erosion of the environmental laws is awful. It really is. And everywhere in the world should be aware of what the problems are with these weapons, because number one, in this country, in the United States, we don't have a repository. No, Carlsbad is not a repository. And we were supposed to have one in 1982. So what are we waiting for? So my perspective is, why do we manufacture something that we don't have a place to put it, the waste? To me, it's getting crazier and crazier that I don't really care. You know, the administration needs to know that we don't like it. And I'm still resisting the Department of Energy. I'm doing that in various different avenues, and I've been doing it since 1987 when they forced their hand. It's like the last year when I met with Congressman Joe Neguse at a friend's house, and we were talking about quality air sampling, monitoring systems, and he wanted to know how I really felt, and I said, you know, when the Department of Energy mouth is moving, it's lying. I can show you things right now that would show you that they're violating the law. But I have to go find an attorney willing to do it and a funding source willing to pay for it. And that's not the way it should be. clean air, clean water, clean land, clean people first. Not a government that can figure out to make money off of all of this. And that's what they're doing. Mr. Brown was just telling us about Navajo land. You know, more and more companies are going to be coming in here into Navajo land, and it's a terrible thing. Navajo land should be able to work this out, not the federal government interceding and telling the Navajo land what to do. This is their country. This is their land, and we should respect it.
And are you still with the FBI?
No, I'm no longer with the FBI. I was out the door in 2004.
And lucky for us that you are.
That afternoon, we started out with three short films. In Exile by Nathan Finch, which explores the U.S. nuclear legacy in the Pacific through the eyes of members of the Marshallese community in Arkansas. Tie Waste is a sly fiction satire by Patrick Thomas that has at its base Taiwan, a nuclear-powered country, facing the issue of how to deal with their nuclear waste. So they've come up with a new plan. Every Taiwanese citizen who is using electricity is responsible for the nuclear waste produced and must store it at home. We see not only the outraged responses of the citizens, but the toll the job of informing them and handing out the waste does to the two young men we follow. And Under the Cloud by director Pedro Reyes Alvarez examines the ongoing legacy of nuclear violence in the American Southwest. It comes from a very activist perspective, featuring powerful and profound activist Pitouche Gilbert and fierce Diné activist Leona Morgan. Leona was there with her booth, Hall No, and I spoke with her after the film.
My name is Leona Morgan, and I'm a co-founder of Hall No. That's H-A-U-L-N-O. And I'm on the planning committee for the International Uranium Film Festival this year, 2025, in Winter Rock.
What was the festival like for you as both a participant on the ground in the lobby sharing information and conversation and also being featured in a very powerful film, Under the Cloud?
Yeah, you know, the film festival is always a good place for you reuniting. I see it as a reunion of not just anti-nuclear activists from all over the world, friends, and then also being on the res. It's also a reunion of other Diné people that come, and some people are just, you know, passing through the museum for other business. Some people are working on coal mining issues or fracking and, you know, here to support. So in general, I see it as a reunion of friends, activists, and also just reminding us why we're doing this. And so watching the films, to be honest, is quite depressing. It can be very heavy. And, you know, it's the reality that people are living with, not just uranium mining, but all the stuff from the uranium fuel chain, either, you know, weapons development or nuclear energy. And then, of course, the waste. So it is really heavy to take in these issues, and then to see everyone in the films, the people, some of them come, and so we have filmmakers here, we have some of the people featured in the films, and so it's just a reality of what we're living with and what their fight is about, and some of us that do the work, what we're carrying. And so it's nice to see everybody and know we're not doing this alone, that we're not carrying these heavy loads on our own, but that we have a community. And so I wish we could have more people. I wish more people would join us, because every time we do these events, it's not just for ourselves to preach to the choir. We're really wanting new people to come in. And this year, there was a lot of intention about having some younger folks get involved. And so even myself, I'm getting older, and it is really hard when we don't see the next generations taking up the work. And so we need to be intentional in the nuclear fight, because it's a forever fight. And we need to be very intentional to plan and make sure there's young people, youth, and the people that are going to carry on the work, not to take on the work that we're doing, but to make it their own fight.
The final two films dealt with the atomic bombing of Japan. In The Horrors of Hiroshima, director Peter Matulevich based the film on the Japanese and American medical teams dispatched to Hiroshima in the days and weeks following the bombing. Director Matulevich said, "I want to depict in unflinching detail the horrific medical and physical effects of the Hiroshima bombings based on reports by the first Japanese and American personnel to enter the city. But note that once General Douglas MacArthur was named Supreme Commander of the Allied Powers and in charge of Japan, all reports on the human aftermath of the bombing was suppressed and not released until the 1960s. The final film was director Greg Mitchell's The Atomic Bowl, Football at Ground Zero and Nuclear Peril Today. Mitchell, who also directed the award-winning Atomic Cover-Up, focuses on the absolute numbnutsery of a football game played in Nagasaki on New Year's Day 1946, near Ground Zero for the second atomic bomb, which killed over 80,000 people just 4 months earlier. Then came a live presentation by the physics chanteuse Linda Williams, fresh off her triumphant performances of the Atomic Cabaret at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in Scotland. With a pre-recorded backup soundtrack and really sharp videos, she presented 20 minutes from her act, including the world premiere of a song she'd just finished writing that afternoon, Haul No, written in honor of Leona Morgan and the activist fighting against the hauling of uranium ore from White Mesa Mill through Navajo Nation. By the time she hit the ending chorus, people were enthusiastically singing along with a song they'd never heard before, clapping to the rhythm and using it as an anthem of anger and hope. Because the song is so new, Linda was able to provide only her backup vocals to share, which we'll use at the end of the show. But once she has the lead vocals recorded, we'll make it available and include an interview with her about it. Then Norman Patrick Brown presented an excerpt from a one-man show he's developing, Corn Pollen, Warriors, Yellow Monsters. Finally, IUFF co-founders Norman Sukhanek and Marcia Gomez de Oliveira presented two Lifetime Achievement Awards to Norman Patrick Brown for his lifetime of Indigenous activism and Jan Budar, a board member of Nuclear Education and Information Service in Chicago. Jan, who is about to turn 90, is still kicking serious nuclear posterior. Then the film festival packed up and prepared to head out in the morning to Las Vegas, where it will again present films, some of them not seen in Window Rock, over 3 days, November 21st to 23rd, at Downtown Cinemas. Admission is free, and all are welcome. And keep in mind that in 2026, the IUFF is intending to come to the U.S. again, probably aiming for Hollywood in October, to coincide with other nuclear-themed events. If you would like to sponsor an edition of the International Uranium Film Festival in your community, contact them directly at uraniumfilmfestival.com. They will welcome you. In closing, at the very end, I was able to speak with Norbert Suchnek on his feelings about this year's festival at Window Rock.
Norbert Suchnek, we have just concluded 2 days of the most amazing nuclear, atomic, uranium films, heavy emphasis on Navajo Nation, but truly touching the universality of the nightmare we have with nuclear. How do you feel having pulled this together and brought it off yet again?
I'm proud about this, very proud, because Window Rock is a very special place. It's a place surrounded by sacred mountains, sacred earth and sacred people. And here we do not only show the films, here we have a big gathering of filmmakers and victims. And this makes this festival in Window Rock a very special event.
What kind of feedback have you gotten from the people here who perhaps have not experienced an International Uranium Film Festival before?
Well, the feedback is like in the last year, you have to come back next year, because most of the people feel alone. But here we are all together, and they feel that, you know, I'm suffering alone at home, but here now we are together, we are a big family, and we can exchange our feelings, and we can exchange our feelings to get stronger and to fight this yellow monster.
Well,
And where do you go from here?
From here, we are going slowly to Las Vegas because we have a very special film festival there in November 21 and 22 and 23, and everybody is invited.
We'll let them know.
And then, as you could hear in the background, there was a final drumming, singing, and circle dance to which we were all invited. A perfect way to close two really important days. As for more nuclear films, if you're in the Los Angeles area, on November 23rd, which is a Sunday, Kath Kramer Films That Saved the World will present On the Beach, Stanley Kramer's brilliant, heartfelt story set in the aftermath of nuclear war in Australia, one of the few places that have not yet been devastated by nuclear radiation. It stars Gregory Peck, Ava Gardner, and Fred Astaire in the bitterest role he ever played in a film. Also being shown is Stanley Kramer's Judgment at Nuremberg. And there will be a think tank panel discussion moderated by Kath Kramer, which I am honored to be a part of. This presentation marks the 80th anniversary of the Nuremberg trials and the atomic bomb drop on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and will be held at the Fine Arts Theater in Beverly Hills. Doors open at 1 p.m. and the program begins at 1:30. And did I mention that it's free? Just mention Nuclear Hot Seat. And finally, my play, Atomic Bill and the Payment Due, which had its world premiere stage reading as part of the 50th anniversary of the Peace Resource Center of Wilmington College in Wilmington, Ohio, is available for readings, staged readings, and full productions. It's an Oppenheimer-adjacent true story of media manipulation at the dawn of the atomic age, and the New York Times reporter who sold his soul to get the story. The presentation at Wilmington College for the Peace Resource Center was so successful, we had a standing ovation and cheers by the end, and this off a staged reading. Student actors, book in hand, chairs on risers, and a few rear screen projections. But the point was made, the show came across, and as one student wrote us in an email the day after, quote, "I will never look at nuclear the same again," end quote. So if you'd like a little bit of that going on in your area, talk to schools, theater groups, people involved with theater, or anybody who might have a couple of million dollars and a hankering for Broadway. For now, this has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, November 18, 2025. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, that makes it easy for you to access it, and you'll never miss another episode. It's easy to sign up, and it is free, of course. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com. There's a big yellow box that pops up, not always on your phone, but always on your computer. When you see that yellow box, put in your first name and an email address, and every week you will get one, just one, email with the link and a short description of the show's content. You can also sign up on any of the streaming services, but if you do it this way, it goes on my database, and Google ends up liking me a whole lot more. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, always, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate to support this work, thank you. Any amount will help us out, and we really appreciate the support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Hartestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, it is never too late to heal the land. That's a direct quote from Ways of Knowing, a Navajo Nuclear History, one of the films that was shown. We're going to go out with music in the background from Linda Williams of her song Hall No. These are her background tracks. We'll have her lead vocal in a few weeks. But for now, there you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat. The poison rolls on. Oh, no!